This is Richard Phillips, trustee of the SEC Historical Society, interviewing Mike Eisenberg, presently Deputy General Counsel of the Commission, but that's his second tour. His first tour started in 1959. The date is Sunday, September 7, 2003. Mike, tell us, when did you first join the SEC and at what point in your career?
I had graduated from Columbia in 1958.
Columbia Law School.
I then was the law clerk to the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, William McAllister. Judge McAllister was a member of the Conference of State Chief Justices, and I had planned to come to Washington to work for the Antitrust Division, and he had given me an introduction to then the Deputy Attorney General, Lawrence Walsh. The Antitrust Division was paying something like $4,600 a year, and I heard from a friend that the Federal Trade Commission would pay $5,200 a year, I think it was, like a GS-7.
So how come you didn't go to work for the Federal Trade Commission?
Because I was interviewed by Daniel Patrick McCauley, who apparently was had been the associate general counsel at the SEC and was then the general counsel of the Federal Trade Commission. He interviewed me, and he says, "You really don't want to work here. There's a really good agency that I know, the SEC. You know anything about the SEC?" Well, I had a vague familiarity with the SEC because one of the problems in a seminar course with Jerry Gunther had an SEC problem in it. But that was my total familiarity with the securities. And he said that he would call. He'd give me a job at the Federal Trade Commission, but he thought I'd like the SEC better. And he called over to Joe Levin, who was then an assistant general counsel, and recommended that I go over there. I met a classmate of mine, Peter Morrison, who was then working in the general counsel's office. He says, "Oh, yeah, you can get a GS-7, I think it was. And that, at that time, the money was important because the difference between $4,600 and $5,200. In any event, Carol was pregnant.
Carol's your wife.
Yes. So I went over and was interviewed by Joe Levin. Tom Meeker was not, the general counsel was not around at the time. He sent me to be interviewed by David Ferber, who was then another assistant general counsel, and David interviewed me on the porch of his house while drinking a martini in his bathrobe. Between the two of them, I was also interviewed by Irv Pollack, who was then an assistant general counsel, and they decided that I should be hired. The whole general counsel's office at the time, I think, had 23 or 24 lawyers. And in addition to doing the appellate work, we also tried our own cases. District court cases. That's how I got to the SEC. That was October 1959.
What's the first major matter that you can recall working on in general counsel's office of the SEC?
The commission had lost the ISI case. It was SEC versus ISI out in the Ninth Circuit, and cert had been denied. And the ISI case involved the transfer of ownership of a investment advisor for a profit. The commission thought that that was a gross abuse of trust under Section 36 because they were transferring what was essentially a trust relationship for a profit, And they fought the case out in the Ninth Circuit and lost. And the question was, why did we lose? And involved in that was the question of what was a gross abuse of trust under Section 36. There had
36 of?
Of the Investment Company Act, which says thou shalt, the commission has the power to bring an action for gross abuse of trust involving investment companies. And I went to go look to see what gross abuse of trust was. The legislative history was pretty sparse. Looked up Bogart on trusts and agency and a whole bunch of other issues where abuse of trust was involved. And that really didn't pan out very much. So we were sort of stuck in terms of what was the origin of the term gross abuse of trust. It had been negotiated during when the 40 Act, just before the 40 Act was adopted, by the commission, by David Schenker, who was the chief counsel of the study. And the words just got into the statute. There was some writing about it, but nothing particularly definitive. It just had to be a serious abuse of trust, or whatever that meant. And anyway, that was the first thing that I got into, and that interest in terms of Section 36, breach of fiduciary duty, what does abuse of trust mean, and is today a live issue, much less back then. I found out how gross abuse of trust got into the statute.
Who was the chairman of the commission at that time?
Chairman of the commission at the time, and when I started, was Ned Gadsby, who had been chairman for, I think, 5 years, had been appointed by President Eisenhower. And, of course, October, that period, 1959, he remained as chairman until President Kennedy appointed William Carey.
Did you notice any significant difference in the commission with the transition from a Republican chairman and a Democratic chairman?
Okay, I'll go back to the other thing in a minute, but not particularly. I mean, I think that if you take yourself back to that time, 1960, that the new younger generation was coming in, and that what Kennedy represented, a new vigor for the government, they had new commissioners were appointed, and it was a very strong commission. On the commission during the Kennedy and the beginning of the Johnson administration were people who had been career SEC and had division heads. Barney Woodside who had been director of Corp Fin, was a commissioner. Manny Cohen, who had also been director of Corp Fin, was also appointed, later became chairman, and that had not really happened before. But in terms of the politics, it was not a political commission. People voted on their philosophy, but nobody ever really thought, I don't think, of people as, well, this is a Republican commissioner, and this is the way he's going to vote because he's a commissioner. You really couldn't tell. Gadsby, and I served as his legal assistant for a period of time when he was holding over after he lost the chairmanship to Carey. It was pretty collegial. It was a collegial commission. It was much smaller. The division directors and associate directors spoke to each other often. The chairman knew what was going on in most divisions. It was our office was an example. There were 23 or 4 lawyers in the office. All of the assistant general counsel were people who had were career, who had been there for almost all of their careers. Pollack, Ferber, and Levin. The general counsel was a political appointee. But that didn't really...
Who succeeded Mr. Meeker?
After he left, Walter North succeeded him. Walter North came from Michigan, was a good Republican from Michigan, and was appointed when Tom left. And that certainly didn't make much difference. And after that, when Bill Carey became chairman, I think the first general counsel was Alan Conwell.
Uh-huh. And Mr. North left, or
no? North stayed on as associate general counsel. There was no thought of really ousting him or anything like that. You didn't have that kind of a change. There was an executive director whose name was Scheidenhelm, and he was ousted. And he was a political person, but in terms of the direction of the commission, I think, because the markets were picking up and there was attention being paid to the markets and the mutual fund industry, particularly because of the Wharton School report, which came out about that time. There were things happening at the commission.
What do you mean by the Wharton School report?
The Wharton School report was a report that dealt with essentially whether or not the fees that were being charged for investment advice and whether the load structure for mutual funds was appropriate. And it was done by a team headed by Irwin Friend, who was a professor at the Wharton School, Andy Brimmer, who later...
Was this done for the commission?
Yes. Andy Brimmer...
Under the Gadsby administration?
It started under the Gadsby administration, and it was picked up. It just went on.
And generally speaking, what was the tenor of the report?
The tenor of the report was highly critical of the industry. The reports, in effect, said that they were not the economies of scale, because the fund industry, sounds funny now, because the whole industry was maybe $40, $50 billion, which is the size of one of the smaller Fidelity funds these days. But the whole industry, the whole mutual fund industry, was $40, $50 billion, and in effect, you had a $400-500 million complex that was big stuff. And consequently, they said that the half of 1%, which was pretty standard across
half
the
of 1% management fee
was in effect didn't provide the benefits of scale. And of course, there was a load structure that started at 8.5%. And they really didn't get into sales tactics that much. That was left later for the special study.
And so what was the result of this report?
The result of the Wharton report was a sharper look into the industry that was picked up by the special study. One of the things that came...
Now,
with
explain what the special study is.
Okay, one of the things that came from the... from the appointment of Carey and the attention given to the markets, it wasn't just mutual funds, it was the fixed commission rate at the New York Stock Exchange and various recommendations that were being bandied about at that time. Part of the special study then was authorized by the Congress, and a staff was assembled when Bill Carey was chairman. Milton Cohn was made the head of that study. Ralph Stahl, who was then the deputy director of Division of Trading and Markets, was made the deputy head of that. And people were gathered from all over the commission and outside the commission. There were about 60 people, if I remember correctly, who were on the staff of this special study. I was detailed to it for allegedly a couple of months. It ended up being the length of the study, which is about a year and a half. And part of that, going back to your question, was mutual fund sales practices. And Chapter 11 of the fund study deals with sales practices, and that's how they got into that. One of the sales practices that were tied to it had to do with the fixed commission rate and the amount of money that was given up or directed by fund managements to brokers to reward fund sales. So that was there was a relationship between the way they were sold and the rewards for distribution, And there was a significant part. I ended up cross-examining publicly Don Regan, who was then executive vice president of Merrill Lynch, and others who were involved in sales. The other part of the study that was very important that I dealt with was the antitrust part of it, which later led to Gene Rotberg, who was then associate director of trading and markets, to what was called the commission rate hearings, in which the fixed commission rate of the New York Stock Exchange was called into question. And one of the reasons that the fixed commission rate was abolished was because of what happened in the special study, the disclosure of the give-ups, and the commission rate hearings that Rotberg conducted.
And were you a member of General Counsel's office during this period?
I was a member of the General Counsel's office, and I went back to the General Counsel's office after the study.
And when were you as Assistant Chief Counsel of the Division of Market Regulation? Not regulated mutual funds, I take it.
Yes. I think it was probably 61 or something like that.
For a short time?
About a year.
And you left General Counsel's office?
Yes. I got a promotion out of it, I think. And we did things like Allegheny, was the Allegheny Corporation hearings, the Murchisons, the takeover of Allegheny. It was pretty interesting.
What was that about?
That was about the takeover. Allegheny was was part of the holding company that owned IDS, Investors Diversified Services, which at that time was one of the largest, if not the largest, mutual fund group in the country, and it was also sold by through independent salesmen, which they controlled. It was not sold through brokers. And
not independent salesmen, but captive salesmen.
They were part of IDS. IDS was the advisor IDS ran. The sales force, and it was a very large sales force. It was headquartered in Minneapolis. And there was a change of control in Allegheny. There was a proxy fight that was involved in it, and the highlight of that was my taking testimony of Mr. Murchison with Abe Fortas as the defense lawyer. We had an interesting time there. Alan Gordon was the chief counsel of the division of, and was the chief counsel of Corp Reg.
Said market reg before. Did you mean corporate
regulation?
Corporate regulation. Which regulated the
mutual
fund
industry and the public utility holding company industry. Anyway, that was just kind of so just to put this in order, you had the Wharton study. The Wharton study criticized the industry on loads and on fees and disclosure, and I think there was some things about the role of directors. There was a significant piece on the role of directors in the Wharton School report. Jack Bogle was then the assistant to Joe Welch, who was at Wellington, who was the chairman of the Investment Company Institute, then called the National Association of Investment Companies. And there was an interesting, Erwin Friend, who was the head of the study, and Andy Brimmer, who, later became a member of the Federal Reserve, and there was another professor. And it led to some very interesting discussions. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, after the Wharton report became public, there was some class action lawsuits brought, mostly by a fellow named Abe Pomerantz, who was a derivative class action lawyer in New York. And he sued a number of the investment complexes on the ground that it was an abuse of trust, gross abuse of trust, for them not to give benefits of scale and the other things, but pretty much based on the Wharton report. And the commission, and when I was in General Counsel's office, the commission authorized us to take the position that there was a private right of action for people like Pomerantz, who represented shareholders, to bring actions under 36. We filed several briefs. I argued part of that. The major case was something called Brown versus Bullock. Bullock was a fund group. And they challenged Sullivan and Cromwell on behalf of Bullock, challenged whether there was a private right of action. This went before Judge Herlins in the Southern District of New York, who apparently was a member of the staff of the commission in the 30s, and he ruled, yes, there was a private right of action. It eventually went to the Second Circuit, which affirmed the private right of action under Sections 10 and 15 and 37. So all of that had to do with
that was
the private
period,
rights of
was
action.
Was that period generally where there was an awful lot of litigation involving the question of whether there were implied rights of action in the federal securities laws and general counsel's office, and you were active in
that.
We
were active in that. And the other branch, as you know, since you were in the office at the time also, was... and by the way, we really had some... it was a small office, but there's some really top-notch people in there, aside from you. But George McKayley was there, Jack Dudley, Malin Frankhauser, later became the regional administrator of New York, Faith Kolish, Mel Katz. There were Paul Gonson came much later. He was not there at that time. But Gonson was there in the latter part of the 60s. Jake Stillman came later in the 60s. But that group people who, and Irv Pollack, who was the head of that and later went on to be a commissioner. But in any event, the other private right of action set of cases were private rights of action under 10B, which is now taken for granted. But that was a big fight. A lot of that, whether or not with Texas Gulf Suffer was the seminal case. I remember in Berkeley when I was teaching this, I said when we went to the commission...
Texas Gulf Suffer was a seminal case on implied rights of action?
No, on insider trading.
Insider trading.
And the question basically became whether or not there was a private right of action under Section 10b-5 on the insider trading cases. Because that's there were a group of cases dealing with private rights of action in which we took the position that there was, and uniformly the courts held that yes, there was a private right of action under 10b, because even though it didn't provide for a private right of action, I think by the time that got to the Supreme Court. No circuit had held it. There was no private right of action. And so you had both those streams of cases under the Investment Company Act and under the 34 Act on private rights of action. As the special study, the things that were coming out of the special study, the basic argument was the fixed minimum commission rate and getting rid of the fixed minimum commission rate. And that took a lot of effort and took a lot of time, and it was successful.
And what was your involvement in that?
Well, I worked with Gene Rothberg, Peter Archie, Dick Paul, who was the chief counsel of the study, and in setting up how give-ups were...
explain what a give-up is.
A give-up is that a fixed commission rate. That means that everybody who were members of the New York Stock Exchange charged the same commission. They would give away to another broker. First, you had to be a member of the New York Stock Exchange, but if Fidelity executed a trade through Merrill Lynch, would give away between 75 and 80% of that commission to whoever Fidelity management would designate, and they would designate people who gave them research or who gave them distribution, who sold shares, and there were other services as well, but those were the two main services. So 80% of the commission was going to whoever the customer, in effect, designated. Well, that didn't last too long because you had to be a member of the New York Stock Exchange Club to do that. So the regional exchanges started doing the same thing. So you could get the same result through a regional exchange. And then that spread to anybody who was a member of the NESD. Well, all brokers are pretty much members of the NESD. So you had the proliferation of these fixed commission rates and the giveaway of that money, which sort of indicated that there was a lot of fat in the commission rate. And consequently, the abolition of the commission rate led to the phase-in of negotiated rates where they could not fix the commission rate. And indeed, it would be in a violation of the antitrust laws for them to do that. After 1975, it was phased in starting in 1970, which is when I left the commission, and it was completed in 1975, May Day 1975, no more fixed commission rates.
You mentioned antitrust and that you had worked on antitrust issues affecting the securities industry while in general counsel's office. Tell us what was happening in that area during your tenure at the commission.
Okay. There were a couple of cases. One was silver versus the stock exchange. And silver was a broker in Texas. You're really testing my memory. Silver was a broker in Texas. It wasn't Dave Silver. Who had his telephonic connections pulled by the stock exchange because he was alleged to have had some relationship to people that were in the Communist Party or was sympathetic to the Communist Party. And this was just after, McCarthy was long gone, but there was a residue of that, and they didn't give him a hearing. They just pulled the lines, which would kill his business. So he brought an action under the antitrust laws that the stock exchange participated in this conspiracy, and he won. And we took the position that that which is necessary to make the Exchange Act work would be immune from the antitrust laws. Therefore, if you have something like an underwriting syndicate and they're setting the price, that's contemplated by the Act. However, if you do some things which are not contemplated, supposing they got together and decided that they would enforce certain discriminatory measures or like this, that they would deny the fellow due process, that wasn't authorized by the Exchange Act, and we won that case in the Supreme Court. The other case was there were a couple of cases. Another one was Kaplan, but the question really was is how much immunity the exchange and the brokers had under the antitrust laws, because but for the existence of the 34 Act, they would not be able to do some of the things that they would do, and that came up again fairly recently, and there still is some significant dispute over the extent and reach of the antitrust laws. There are some people who think that there is blanket immunity for brokers in the antitrust laws, a position which I have great difficulty with.
Now, the Silva case came up around in the mid-70s?
No,
mid-60s, I'm sorry. What other developments were significant during that time?
Then there was after the special study, as you know, there was the mutual fund study. And the mutual fund study consisted of also a special team that was put together, which was an interesting way of dealing with these problems, which we don't have now, which is one of the differences. Divisions are much more turf conscious now than they were then. It was normal to put together a cross-divisional team with people from our office or Corp Reg or Trading and Markets to do this, these things. In any event,
you mentioned the mutual fund study.
The mutual fund study was put together, and we got a group of people together. I remember Dennis Lehr was on that, Larry Newman. There were a couple of others that were there, and that basically we went out to the industry and did pretty thorough interviews of five or six major fund complexes to test whether or not some of the Wharton School conclusions were really still valid. At one point, I think after the first cut of the study, you came in as director of the study to finish it up. But the result of that was...
was after Bill Kerry left.
This is during Manny Cohen's term. Bill Kerry left shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated, and President Johnson, I think he lasted for some time into the Johnson administration, not that long, and he appointed Manny Cohen, who was then a commissioner, to the chairmanship, and he completed that, and it was... The report that came out of that study was public policy implications. And the public policy implications made specific recommendations about reform of the mutual fund industry. The special study did it for the brokerage industry, and this did it for the mutual fund industry, and that had to do with... The front-end sales loads and market tactics and give-ups. There was a section there that dealt with some of the things that we brought up in the special study in terms of distribution and also there was a significant section on management fees. At that time, I think the mutual fund industry was a whole...
And that was
$80 billion.
And that was 1966.
That was 66. Was
the end of 1966 when that was published.
When that was published.
And that was during Chairman Cohen's.
That was during Cohen's.
Tell me the difference, if you can, between Chairman Kerry's administration and Chairman Cohen.
Well, they were just totally different personalities. Kerry was an academic. He was a tough guy, but it was in terms of he was very gentlemanly. He was very knowledgeable. He was pretty friendly, approachable. But I wouldn't say that Bill Kerry was an outgoing personality. Commission was very collegial. At the time, but Manny, who was much more of an outgoing personality and was really recognized as one of the true mavens of securities law, you know, he probably knew as much as anybody in the country about securities law, including Lew Laws. Manny knew where all the bodies were buried. Had been at the commission for 25 or something like that years. He came to the commission after World War II. Nevertheless, it was still a very collegial commission, although there were differences. And
During Kerry's administration, who were the other members of the commission, can you recall?
I got mixed up between...
During this period, Jack Whitney...
Well, he brought Jack Whitney on. Jack Whitney was a Bell Boyd partner from Chicago. He also brought, who else was put on? Frank Wheat.
Frank Wheat.
Frank Wheat was a senior partner at Gibson Dunn and was also a very well-known and very highly respected securities lawyer. Whitney was also a securities lawyer.
Senator Freer.
President Johnson appointed Senator Freer of Delaware as a commissioner, and there was pretty much always a place for somebody who was had Hill connections, either a senator, sometimes a representative that would, and those. People were generally fairly useful. Senator Freer got us our new building on 500 North Capitol, and Lyndon Johnson came to swear him in. He came to the old tar paper shack on Second Street.
That was the World War I temporary.
It was temporary. It was a temporary building, and it showed it. And that was the commission headquarters. It is now a poor people's center.
Shelter.
The shelter.
When did the commission move? During your tenure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When Johnson came to swear Freer in, he looked around. He saw a shabby tar paper shack, and he said, "We're going to have to get you a new building." And they did. And the result was the move to 500 North Capitol. I became executive assistant to Manny Cohen. That was after we tried the fifth. There were two major cases that were involved.
How long were you in general counsel's office?
Except for the period that I was executive assistant.
And how about
to Manny, I was in general counsel.
When did you become executive assistant to Manny?
Let's see, after Dave Ratner left, I guess it was 68.
Dave Ratner was who?
But Dave Ratner was Manny's executive assistant. He was a professor from Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy before him was Leonard Lyman, who was a partner in I forget what firm. But anyway, they were first-rate people. Carey's executive assistant was Arthur Fleischer, who became a very well-known M&A lawyer and a senior partner at Free Frank. So you really had some interesting shoes to fill, especially with Manny, who was so knowledgeable about everything.
And you became his assistant when?
68. I was his assistant from 68 until he until Nixon became president and replaced him in February of 69. And Hamer Budge became was on the commission. Budge had served on the commission for 3 or 4 years, appointed by Johnson originally. And he was a former representative from Idaho. And he was president, he was chairman for a while, but being...
Have we covered the significant events during the Casey, the Carey?
Casey had some pretty interesting events, but I wasn't there.
The Carey administration?
I think so. I think during the Carey administration, the major accomplishments of the Carey was the starting of the special study and the manning of the special study, and setting out the what they wanted to do and the reforms that they were going to take on, and also the insider trading stuff.
Were there any significant cases or events that you participated in during this period, other than what we've described?
Well, later...
What about Fifth Avenue Coach?
No, Fifth Avenue Coach came in 67, which was after the mutual fund study. And I went back to... I was an assistant general counsel. I think we both made assistants at the same time. And I was assigned to the Fifth Avenue Coach case. Fifth Avenue Coach case was involved... a condemnation award of about $30 million, which was a lot of money in those days, when New York City condemned Fifth Avenue Coach. The people that ran Fifth Avenue Coach and proceeded to loot the company, the award of $30 million, included Roy Cohn, Kroc.
Who was Roy Cohn?
Roy Cohn was the chief counsel of Senator McCarthy of Wisconsin, not Minnesota, of his investigating committee, and was basically responsible with McCarthy for some of the things that happened in the early 1950s, blacklists, accusing people of being communists. There were communists in the State Department. There were communists under the rug. There were communists.
And Fifth Avenue Coach was then an administrative proceeding, a court proceeding.
No, it was a court proceeding, and it was assigned to our office, and we put a team together, which included the chief counsel of every division had its own enforcement group, which that is not true today. And Dave Butowski and Sid Mendelson were the counsel there. Dave Butowski was assigned to it. Ted Sondi from our office was assigned to it.
Butowski and Mendelson were from what division?
They were from investment management, or then Corp Reg. Sondi was in general counsel's office.
So this was a joint general counsel division of investment management.
Yeah, team. we had an accountant. It was Loomis, I think, was from Corp. Tao was from Corp Fin.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a financial analyst type. Bill Smith was from Butowski's office. And we were going to try this case, and what it involved was that these people got together and they were going to take that $30 million, and it involved bags of money going to England with the Panama ambassador to England, and other CDs in Panamanian banks and Swiss banks. It was really quite a story, and we investigated it. The first thing we did was to bring an action in the Southern District of New York. Went up and argued for an injunction against them. And the interesting thing about it was that it was an Investment Company Act case, because we argued that this was an unregistered investment company. They'd taken the pool of money and they were investing it. And a lot of junk, but they were investing it and taking the money out, and it was unregistered, and they were saying, no, it was not an investment company. And then, of course, there was a fraud charge. It was a...
What was the result?
The result was that after, I think it was an eight-week trial before a wonderful judge, his name was Edward McLean. He's a wonderful judge, not just because we won, but because he was really a fine judge. He put us through what we would have had to go through in a criminal trial to do this. And the commission got an injunction. A special trustee was appointed to take charge of the money. The commission basically won its case, and the recommendation that Mr. Cohen be disbarred as a member of the New York Bar never went any place, and he wasn't disbarred until many years later.
This was the first time, was it not, that Mr. Cohen lost a case?
It was the only case, as far as I know, that Roy lost to the government. And Bob Morgenthau, who was the United States attorney at the time, had tried Cohen on sort of not related to Fifth Avenue, but other cases of that he had that were criminal cases. Cohen managed to get a hung jury on one because one of the jurors' fathers died, and that was the end of that. And then they lost, I think, another case. So it was. This was the only case that Cohen ever lost.
And considered a very significant victory.
There's no question that it was a significant victory. We got a promotion out of it. The other really important case, I mean, of course, there was Texas Gulf Sulphur in that, but I was involved, but not. That was not a thing for me. I was in Great American Industries and a couple of other cases that we tried. But the real case was Fifth Avenue and iOS. iOS was fund of funds, Bernie Kornfeld, and at that time it was a pretty big case. What they were doing was that they had these offshore funds that were being sold overseas, but were investing in the American stock market, and they were selling to servicemen and people overseas and so on. And it was a fairly big fraud because they would use give-ups. There was the receptacle for the give-ups was a Cuban skin diver named Martica Clapp, who lived in the Bahamas, and money would go to Switzerland and end up in the Bahamas and all of that. They were very successful. If they had done what they had done honestly, it was a good business, but they got very greedy. And we pursued the case, and the case was originally brought, what's our jurisdiction? Why does the commission have jurisdiction over this stuff which is happening overseas? So we started searching for places where iOS was doing business in the United States, and two things happened. One was we got a missive from the United States Attorney in Guam, which said that they were selling in Guam. Guam is American territory. So we detailed Alan Gordon to go to Guam. The telegram to the United States Attorney apparently went to the IOS agent Don Guam, who contacted his people in Switzerland, and David Silver was detailed, who was then acting for iOS to go to Guam. The reason that Alan Gordon was detailed, he was supposed to go to Hawaii to some conference. They didn't know that. And he stayed in Hawaii for about a week, and poor Silver was out in Guam with the gnats and huge with snakes and so on.
That's a David Silver went on to become president of the ICI,
correct. Eventually, he would check every Pan Am flight that came in. Eventually, Gordon landed. Of course, they knew each other, and Silver was delighted to see this, the Inquisitor come. Anyway, so we had Guam. I went down to Puerto Rico, where they decided they would fight the commission subpoena. So the first part of it was a commission enforcement action, which I argued before Judge Concio, which is relevant. Basically, it was a Puerto Rican court, and I had been before Concio before on a Puerto Rico capital case, which was the first investment company case in the history of Puerto Rico. And this whole question about whether
Meyer, Mike Eisenberg, continued on the second side of the tape.
And in any event, I mean, there are various stories that go along with the iOS case. The sum and substance of the case, aside from the colorful characters and how the thing was defended, and some of the how we beat them in Puerto Rico, where it was just poor me against all these guys from Alan Conwell and the Wilkie Farr people. And one of the interesting...
This was the Conwell who was general counsel of the commission at one time.
He was director of investment management also, and then left, and Wilkie Farr was IOS's counsel. But, of course, I had argued before Concio before, and it was really funny. Attorney General of Puerto Rico, Hernandez Colon, who later became governor, introduced me to the court, which was really a riot because he came in and Concio had previously been the Attorney General. And it was this whole scene about all these guys in suits sitting at one table and me sitting at the other table. And the door was flung open and Hernandez Colon comes in and Concio gets up and says, "For what purpose does the Attorney General appear in my court?" And it was really great stuff. So I was admitted pro hoc vici for the case. And the important thing of the iOS case, it had to do with the extent of U.S. jurisdiction over things that were happening overseas but affected the American markets. And to that extent, it would, aside from the cast of characters and all of that, it was quite important.
And the end result was that iOS was closed down.
Yes, that was interesting, too. The best that some of our colleagues in what became the Enforcement Division could do was get a 5-year bar. David Ferber and I and who else was involved? I think it was Saul Friedman, the director, said these guys should be out of business. And they said to us, okay, you go negotiate this. So we went and we did negotiate it. And we came back with a permanent bar, which is as much as they could do.
Mainly keeping them out of the United States.
Keeping them out of the United States and, of course, pretty much discrediting them.
And thereafter, the Swiss government took some action.
Swiss government took action, and pretty much iOS was discredited.
Any other significant event during your first tenure at the commission, which, as I recall, ended in 1969?
In 1970. After Manny left, I became associate general counsel, and my job was to help shepherd the Investment Company Act amendments of 1970, prepare testimony. Phil Loomis was the general counsel. This should not go by without a talk about Phil. Phil Loomis was truly a genius, was a great general counsel, knew as much as anybody, was a very reticent fellow, and was a real Jem to work for. He would sit and he would rearrange a brief and visualize it and do it in a half an hour, the stuff that you would struggle over for 3 hours, Phil Loomis could solve. And he was truly amazing person, and I think somebody who too many people have forgotten. Phil was, I think, among the best people I ever worked for. Went back, and there was testimony to be given. Senator Williams was, I guess first it was Sparkman, then Williams was the chairman. This had gone on for several years after the mutual fund study and started in 67. And by 68, they were really ready to have a bill. And there were hearings, and the bill passed, much to some people's surprise. There were some compromises made, but essentially, at least from my point of view, the commission got what it wanted. Manny was very involved in this. When Manny was forced out in February of 69, the Budge Commission took over, but the momentum kept up. And we saw it through, and Judge Budge, he was a judge in Idaho at one point. He was called Judge Budge. He testified. The others testified. The commission was fairly strong at the time, that went forward, and that was a very important piece of business, which resonates till today in terms of the beginning of mutual fund reforms that were legislated.
And that legislation did what?
That legislation strengthened the role of independent directors. Basically recognized the responsibility of the funds in terms of reasonableness of fees. 36 was divided into two pieces, which I won't go into now, and which basically set higher fiduciary standards than existed before, with the load, and front-end loads were severely affected. Subject to NASD limitations. It was an important piece of legislation.
You left the commission in 1970.
Yes.
And what did you do?
Well, I left the commission. I almost became a partner. Manny asked me to go with him to Wilma Cutler, and they didn't want to give me a partnership. So I went to another firm. It was called All Sterling and Kent, and they opened a Washington office, and we had that was later absorbed by Rosamond Cohen, and I became a Rosamond partner. Let's say I went through midlife crisis in 1985-86. I went to Berkeley to teach. I was director of a center, National Center of Financial Services, and I taught a course on federal regulation of financial institutions. That was a wonderful experience. I'm still in touch with some of the students I had. It was the only center like that in the country. We had a board that had the chairman of the SEC, vice chairman of the Fed, and a lot of people from industry. A lot of the stuff had to do with, firewalls, the capital markets, but also the SNL scandal, which was brewing on the horizon. I was innocently plying my trade. I went to Ballard Spar.
After you left Berkeley?
After I left Berkeley.
You were at Berkeley for how long?
I was at Berkeley for almost 2 years. I came back. Rosamond had closed its office. I was a Ballard Spar partner. And then after a while, I went to Cramer Levin for 3 or 4 years. And I was innocently attending an ABA meeting in Toronto when Harvey Goldschmidt was the general counsel who I had known for a long time because I was on the CorPro group of the ABA, the corporate governance group, and he was a reporter on the ALI corporate governance along with Mel Eisenberg and Marshall Small. And Jack Coffey, he recruited me, basically. He said that he wanted to have a deputy, and we negotiated a little bit, and the kids were through school and they were married, and so it sounded like a good thing to do, and I was sort of tired of billing time and running after clients, and so it worked out well. Arthur Levitt was the chairman.
When was this?
This was 99. This was the tail end of 1999. So it will be 5 years, almost 5 years.
And Harvey Goldsmith was general counsel, and you were deputy
general
counsel.
That's right.
And you stayed at the you're still at the commission.
I'm still at the commission.
And you've been through how many chairmen?
I've now been through. I survived Harvey Pitt's chairmanship barely. That was really not a good time for the commission. Not a good time for the staff. And Bill Donaldson obviously took his place. And Donaldson pretty much runs a collegial commission. There is no political division like there was under Pitt. Goldschmidt and Donaldson and Campos get along, and they get along together. The votes don't split down party lines. There's generally consensus. When they do split, it's really sort of ideological.
Let me ask you this.
No, wait,
you
one more thing.
Yeah.
The difference is that it's a much bigger commission with a
the
lot of...
The difference between your first tenure at the commission, right, and your present tenure.
Right, and it's a larger bureaucracy. I think it's harder to run. The problems are, I think, more difficult than they were before. At least they're more complicated. The markets are more complicated. We didn't really have derivatives like we have now. The mutual fund industry is $6.5 trillion instead of $40 billion. The markets are international, accounting standards. You still have the similar banality in terms of that there are people out there, like the Enron situation, which was more complex than some of the things that we dealt with, which were much more raw in terms of the kinds of frauds that we're talking about. So things were more complicated and more difficult to...
But you're saying, except for the Pitt administration, you don't see an increase in partisanship?
That's right. The only other time where this happened was Watergate, when Bill Casey was chairman. And the difference was that Bill Casey had Irv Pollack and Stan Sporkin there directing enforcement, and they, I think, successfully resisted any attempt to politicize the commission. Of course, we did have a chairman who was indicted, Brad Cook, and he was chairman for 3 months or something like that. So that was a really awful period for the commission. But the commission's integrity, I think, was saved by people like Irv Pollack and Stan Sporkin. Other than that, the politicization during the Pitt part of it was unfortunate, but not anything like Watergate.
Has the commission itself retained the same kind of collegiality as existed during your first tenure?
I think it pretty much has.
Notwithstanding things like legislation that prevents the commissioners from getting together?
As far as I'm concerned, the Sunshine Act, as it's called, is a impediment to effective governance of the commission, and I realize why it's in place and that it serves both to serve a good purpose, and to some extent there are things that ought to be public should be public. But one of the things during, for instance, the Kerry and Cohen administrations was that the commissioners could get together and argue things out and talk things through and reach a consensus and respect each other, and usually you could find a middle ground. When you now have an open commission meeting, you have set speeches, pretty much. I mean, the fight that was at the open meeting, where the PCAOB appointment of Webster was clearly an outlier. I mean, that's the only time that I've ever seen a commission meeting like that. But usually it sets speeches, they're ready to do it. The enforcement meetings, which are closed and legitimately closed, you get much more of a back and forth, an evaluation, a discussion. The staff doesn't have set speeches at the enforcement than the other private meetings, whereas in the public meetings, as you know, I mean, they sit and they talk through.
But they still have to confine their discussions to formal commission meetings.
Yeah,
which is unlike the situation.
Yeah, they could get together
in the 1960s.
Right. I mean, Weed and Smith and Cohen and Owens, they get together and they talk something through, and informally. They'd walk into Barney's office and they'd sit down and talk it through.
Well, let me ask you this: what about collegiality and working together between the different divisions? Do you still have the examples of interdivision teams?
No, that's unfortunate, and maybe it's a product of the one is the product of turf, but it's also a product of the fact that there are so many more people in the division, and that there, I think, is much more turf jealousy than I've seen. But you're talking about a commission with many times the size that it was during the 30 years ago. So that leads to we really don't have very many situations where you have joint teams. We now have issues on the table where Market Reg and IM, investment management, really ought to be getting together. And yeah, they talk, but attacking something jointly is not really done very much. And also, there are other players which didn't exist before, like the Office of Compliance and Inspections, which has a role in some of this stuff.
Let me ask you one final question, and then give you a chance to add anything. How, in what respects has the commission not changed today from your prior tenure?
I think that it has always had interesting and exciting and important things to do. Now, it wasn't War and Peace or settling the world's problems, but we always felt that there was a pride in being a part of the commission, and that the commission was doing doing its job. The fact that the collegiality may not have been there for a while, or the fact that there's turf problems, still you have really very good people who really want to do a good job, and then generally it works. And there's a real pride in doing that. When we go to the Solicitor General's office on some of the cases that we've won, and we say, well, this office, the General Counsel's office, is one of the best that we have to deal with.
And that was true in the 60s, and
that was true
today.
In the 60s, and it was true today. And the work that's put out of the office is really first-class work, and we win most of our cases. And the SG's office, who we work the Supreme Court cases through, is a terrific help, whether it's Democrat or Republican, whether it's Ted Olson or Waxman. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't.
Is there anything you want to add to this interview?
Well, I've always thought that there ought to be a book written about some of the interesting, funny stuff that went on that really doesn't get told. And this is not the time or place to tell it. But there are so many interesting characters around that people don't really know about or will die with people when the memories go. That it really is too bad. And there's iOS stories and Fifth Avenue stories, and there are a whole bunch of things now with the big settlement and the rest of it. And I think that's too bad that will be lost. But the other thing is that the institutional memory is fading. It used to be that the people you dealt with had been there for years and years. You could not be an assistant director in the Division of Corporation Finance unless you'd come up through the ranks. It was not political. The director of the division was not political. The general counsel was, but the others were not. And consequently, you now have people who are younger and less experienced in positions of to make decisions, and that shows.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eisenberg.
You're welcome very much, Mr. Phillips.
This is the end of our interview.